surrounding the housing crisis.
Si votre dernier vaccin contre la COVID-19 remonte à plus de 5 mois, c'est le moment d'aller chercher une nouvelle dose. Faire le plein d'anticorps permet de réduire le risque d'avoir ou de transmettre le virus, en plus de contribuer à diminuer le nombre d'hospitalisations et de décès liés à la COVID-19. Pour une meilleure protection contre le virus, prenez rendez-vous au québec.ca/vaccin-COVID et suivez la séquence de vaccination recommandée. La vaccination contre la COVID-19, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Do not miss acclaimed electronic artist and trailblazer Marc Ribier at Place Belle on Friday, October 21st, as part of his North American 2022 tour. Marc Ribier. Tickets available at evenco.ca. Visit www.marcribiellet.com. That's marcribier.com for more information.
Thank you. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca on the web. This is If You've Got Ears. We just heard two pieces from the album Rebetica by Yanis Kyriakidis and Andy Moore. We heard the tracks Minoris and Katsouros. I had the good fortune to sit down yesterday with Yanis Kyriakidis and Andy Moore to talk about this piece, which they will be performing this coming Sunday at Espace Wilfrid downtown with the Bozzini Quartet. They'll also be performing a piece that Yanis wrote called Cassettes. Pretty exciting. So we'll start by hearing part one of the conversation with Yanis Kyriakidis and Andy Moore. Let's listen.
So maybe you could just start, one of you, by telling the audience or CQT's listeners what Rebetica music is. I'd like to hear how you would, either of you would define
it. Go, Yanni.
Well, Rebetica music is songs from the beginning of the 20th century, and they're immigrant songs brought from Asia Minor, Turkey, by Greeks who were displaced. Throughout the period from the 1910 to the 1930s, and mostly this music was created in the port of Athens. So it's a lot of there was a kind of ghetto around there of this kind of Turkish immigrants, which weren't particularly welcome. Turkish Greek immigrants, I'd say, which weren't particularly welcome in Greece at the time. So they really existed in the sort of subculture, lower classes. And involved in a lot of the subcultural activities, whether it was, drugs, criminal activities. The music has this, what's special about the music is that it was very much influenced by the kind of traditional Ottoman, the more Turkish modal compositions. Of course, a lot of Greeks were part of that kind of Ottoman tradition in Turkey, and they somehow infused that with this kind of simpler and kind of a new sound in a way. It had nothing to do with really this kind of folk or traditional sound. They really found their own kind of hard sound to it. And there was a kind of simplicity and also a kind of grittiness to the lyrics, and it really dealt with their lives. And it became immensely popular very quickly, partly because of the explosion of records in the 1920s and 1930s, but also because there was a huge wave of immigration also to America at that time. So a lot of some America, Columbia had a kind of office in Athens that were producing these records also. So it really appealed also to immigrant Greeks, I think, for some time who moved out of Greece. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. That's very in-depth description. Would either of you say that it's popular music, or would you say it's a folk music?
It's sort of. I don't think it was a. I don't think it was a like folk music.
It was seen as a traditional folk music.
No, and it was popular for like I think for 10, 20 years at the time, and then because of the war, like the Second World War, it somehow the whole way people looked at that music changed. So, like after the war, there was also a right-wing government. There was a sort of you know, the first military dictatorship in a way, like, and they really almost banned this music. And I think there was a whole generation of Greeks who just didn't listen to it, didn't think anything of it. And yeah, it was more like a kind of, it kind of represented aspects of the culture they didn't want to associate as being Greek, even because they a lot of Greeks saw it as being Turkish music, you know, like or like because also about drugs and prostitution, but they just didn't want to be associated with it. So it had to do with this kind of middle classes that were sort of growing then, but also the kind of right wing censorship on culture. So there was in the 50s and 60s. It sort of disappeared, and it was only brought back actually in the 60s by Theodorakis, Hadjidakis, these left-wing Greek composers who sort of somehow resurrected it in a way and sort of say, hey, listen, this is our music, and they can so it had a bit of a revival only then.
Yeah.
And, but it was also it was the lyric, because of the lyrics, a lot of the it was banned from being played, so you ended up with this instrumental version also, and they got much more into
the bouzouki
players, and there's a whole kind of line of these brilliant, but the original songs were much more based around actual songs, like words with words, and the lyrics are, I mean, the lyrics are heavy. It's really it's, you can see how if you were a fascist dictator, you wouldn't want those words to be spread around or something.
Yeah. And very emotional. And,
sorry?
And sometimes very emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Once, I like, it always makes me laugh. You Called Me a Bum One Night is the name of the song.
It's
a harsh insult.
But also, there were songs about tuberculosis, TB, about heroin, a lot about hash, being in prison.
But there's also like there's a kind of traditional side to that, which is like the amanades, which are these more kind of it's a bit like this style of flamenco where you have like two lines of text, you know, which are improvised on, and that comes from more traditional music, and that would be also quite heavy text about, you know, the sort of the pain of life, and you know and also even like often this idea of like celebrating in the face of, you know, suffering, a bit of kind of stoic, you know, which is where that all comes from. This sort of stoicism does come from like Western Turkey, you know, so-called Asia Minor. So there is that mix of that kind of, you know, making songs about the difficulties of life, but also, you know, enjoying the sort of, you know, the pain, the difficulties of it in some way. Sort of blues, kind of blues.
That's a comparison that often seems to come up. And I mean, it does, sometimes tonally, it does sound similar. Scales or whatnot. Yeah. How did you each discover Rebecca?
I, Channel 4. Channel 4 put out this series of, I was living in Edinburgh, and we were really listening to a lot of, we kind of listened to all this guitar music and bands for years, and then we started looking further out. And so we started listening to a lot of African music, but also East European music. Yeah. And Channel 4 put out this documentary. I can't remember how many parts there are, 3 or 4 or something. And we just by chance came across it, and we were like, this is amazing music. But at that time, there were, you know, you could, especially in Edinburgh, you couldn't get anything.
No.
And I remember this Greek guy sent a letter to us, because the band Dogface Hermans.
Yeah.
And he said, I really love your band, but I can't afford to pay for your records. Can you send me a record and I'll send you a kind of Greek hardcore band or a Greek... And we said, send us some Rembetika.
Yeah.
And he sent us this cassette of Rembetika music. And it was amazing. I still have it.
Wow.
I used it for a long time when we were playing together.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of start of getting access to it. I mean, slowly over the years, we managed to find little bits of it. But... And then when I met Yanni, I can't remember how we met, through Joe or something.
Yeah, in the sort of music scene somewhere.
And that when I discovered that he had Greek, Cypriot Greek roots, I asked him about it. And he was the first person, actually, that I knew that he knew about the music. Because at that time, that was like...
Early 80s, mid 80s
when we first discovered it.
Yeah.
And hardly anyone outside Greece knew about it.
Yeah, that's
still
right.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you discover it?
Well, because I'm Greek Cypriot, but I was sort of, since the age of 5, I grew up in England.
Yeah.
And then when I was 18, I had this thing, I wanted to go to Greece, and because I was an ordinary musician then, but more from the classical tradition. I wanted to learn about the traditional music in Greece. So I went there, and I was traveling in Greece, and I met Ross Daly, who is this amazing Greek musician. He's actually Irish, but he sort of lived most of his life in Greece, and he plays, he's like multi-instrumentalist, but he also played this kind of Turkish traditional music. And it was the late 80s, and there was this kind of group of young musicians, my age, a bit older maybe, like that time, who really wanted to learn Turkish classical music. But they also all played Rebetika, because they were really fascinated by that music. So I spent some time, and they were, you know, really learning the... I was playing violin, but then I started playing oud also, and really learning the traditional Turkish, you know, classical music. But then in the meantime, hearing from the other musicians all this Rebetika, and going to their gigs and hearing them playing it also, which was so that's how I sort of discovered it as well. And and I never really thought of doing anything with it until actually I met Andy.
And first we had a band.
Me,
Yanni, and a Ukrainian guy from Odessa called Alec Coppet. He would play accordion, and I played guitar, and Yanni played. He played violin and oud. Right?
Amazing.
We did it a few times, but we also thought we're just kind of doing a kind of traditional version of traditional music or something. We did a couple of gigs, I think. And it was kind of nice to do, but it didn't really.
Didn't it also feel that authentic in a way?
Yeah, and also I was never interested in playing authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Music, because that didn't really make sense. That wouldn't be the reason to do it also.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of
frittered
out a bit. It just sort of fizzled out.
And then in the meantime, we were playing a lot in the improv scene, just the electronics and guitar. And then at some point I got asked by, there was a kind of startup in Glasgow, this guy, before his time, it was
John Smith, from
Red Note,
yeah.
And he had this idea to have a kind of music subscription service that every month would release a new CD, and you could subscribe to it. You didn't have to buy the release, and every month you get a new sort of release. And we were at the launch of this. He invited us to be in the launch of this event, and then we said, what should we do? And then and his company was called six of my favorite things, or six something like that, my favorite thing. And I thought, since it's on that subject, let's go back to the Rembetika and try and do something else with it. So that's how this project came about.
Did you initially, like, what, how did you come to the idea of, like, samples and guitar?
Well, that's what we had. That's how we often played.
Okay, like, that's what you were doing.
So, when we first started playing together, I was basically doing a lot of live sampling.
Yeah.
Like, so that's how we just build up stuff like that. And then with the Rumbetica, it was the question of how to bring it in. You know, whether we would play the tunes or I would refer to the records by making, and that's how we. That's how we started doing it, that I would, Andy would say, let's, you know, here's some tracks, let's do something with these pieces, and then I would sort of make some kind of treatment of it, in some way, I, you know, maybe just taking samples or getting the general atmosphere, processing the whole track or something, and I would send him a sort of like these kind of tracks, and then he would listen to it and think, you know, what he would do on it, whether it would be playing the melody or, you know, doing something just with a harmony or a drone or whatever. And then we'd sort of go back and forth a few times, and then we'd sort of... And then it would develop in a live context also.
Yeah,
yeah, that's how... Yeah.
So it's hard to tell listening to it whether some pieces, you know, whether it's... I mean, it sounds improvised at times, but not always.
Yeah.
Well, the first... That first CD, that was the first gig we played.
Yeah.
That was just recording of
it.
Straight off. And I mean, most of it was improvised. For me, most of it was improvised. There was a few bits where I tried to play the melody.
Yeah.
But mostly it was...
Yeah, but also it was...
And also you were improvising.
I was improvising, but I had this kind of...
Matrix.
These tracks that I'd made that I would bring in, you know, at times. And like, so it was, we called them, more like sort of backing tracks.
That
are more composed, let's say.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, this kind of, we have this kind of live interaction.
It's interesting. It's quite a... I didn't realize that it was so... such an old piece. I mean, it's not that old, but it's for 14 years or something.
Yeah, or longer.
I don't know. The Rumbetica,
2006.
Yeah, 2006,
so
yeah.
18 years.
Yeah, 18 years, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then we sort of we kept adding stuff on, and then we made this the second one, which is a billion heartbeats. Life is a billion heartbeats.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was a slightly different approach with that.
Yeah.
Right? Because I also played some guitar lines and sent them to Yanni, and you worked directly with my guitar.
Yeah. And then some pieces that we sort of recorded, and then we sort of added this kind of Rumbetica element, and then worked with that on top.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
So that kind of, that was a different creative path, but they all ended up somehow. You know, when we've done the set, you know, we don't do the set that often. Like, this is the first time we're doing it for like quite a
few years,
five, six years. I don't know. Like,
Was it a request, or did you just say,
it was actually, they actually asked for it, no?
For Canada,
yeah,
I think we could have done anything. I think, and we were thinking of doing the idea of doing something
pavilion
or something totally new. Actually, because I thought, we did Pavilion 2 years ago.
What's Pavilion?
Pavilion
is our last CD.
Okay,
and that was a CD we recorded in the Venice Biennale in a pavilion, the French pavilion, of Xavier
Vellon.
But yeah, so we thought, let's do a new project. So then we started, brainstorming about a project. But then we thought, Rumbetica, we've never done that actually at all in North America, because we've played in the States before. We did Folia.
We played in Greece before.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we just thought, you know, let's go back to the Rumbetica, you know.
Thank you.
was a track called A School Burnt Down by Yanis Kyriakidis and Andy Moore from their 2006 recording Rebetika. Let's continue now with a conversation that I had with the composer and the musician yesterday. And again, they'll be playing this coming Sunday at Espace Wilfrid, October 16th, with the Bozzini Quartet. Thanks for listening.
So with Rebetika, there's the Zydeckico dance that mm-hmm. goes yeah. with it, which I think is just fantastic. Have you ever thought, or did it ever cross your mind incorporating dance in some way?
We were talking about the other day. I was saying to Yanni, "Hey Yanni, let's make a kind of dance, a dance version of this. You know, for people to actually dance." But we decided.
I thought. Well, there is a dance. There are some dance numbers there, but yeah. people wouldn't know how to dance.
That's also true.
We'd have, you know, yeah. it's either because with the Rebetika, you either have like the with the Shiftadeli, sort of the more like the kind of the belly dancing type yeah. thing, you know, which is more like 2/4 or whatever 4/4, yeah. and there's a Zydeckico, which is this kind of slow 9,
yeah. Yeah.
which is which I love, you know, the music. The, yeah. Some of these pieces are just so, and I mean. I can dance it because I remember as a kid, you know, we were dancing it also, you know, in weddings and whatever,
yeah.
and also later, like when you're totally drunk. But the
yeah,
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do.
Be careful.
You suddenly leave your electronics and keep playing, and you just stop.
Or someone in the audience might feel moved
to push
the table aside.
Exactly, and break some place. That's why I want to invite some Greek people to the gig.
But on the other hand, I mean, the thing also about this project is it sort of looks at it from a distance. It's not like... I don't think I would like to sort of present that this is the kind of Rebetika experience in any way. No. Because it's something totally... And I feel as though we're looking at it really from... you know, this distance of a century almost, or literally a century,
and also 100 years,
and also culturally, you know, the okay, in a sense, you know, we're musicians, I have this Greek heritage, and but at the same time, you know, maybe like my fascination with it also has to do with a kind of immigrant experience as well, you know, and like that's how you can relate to it as well, and so we approach it like that also, like it needs, I think it needs distance, and maybe that's why I feel as though we can do it in some way, like it, I don't feel as though we're appropriating the music in a sense that this is the music,
we're not
a kind of comment on it,
we're not using like the traditional instruments, the only way we use the traditional instruments is the samples that Yanni takes, but we're not. And we have no interest also. We had a go at that, and we also realized that's not what we were trying to do. So I also like that I have my sound still, Yanni has his sound.
Yeah.
And we just find.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that it's 100 years old, because it sounds quite haunted, and it also sounds like an act of time traveling in a weird way.
Mm.
Like, the two, it's very, like, the two worlds are very present at the same time. It's like that, I find that really interesting about it.
What do you mean? What the our version of it, you mean? Mm-hmm. Right.
The piece is, like, very, I don't know how to describe it, other than it sounds like these two times sort of coexisting.
I find that very interested in that sort of, mm-hmm. you know, idea of this kind of ontology or the idea of different times existing,
mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, when you have also the idea of the record and what that mm-hmm. is also a kind of time document of something that you are also using in a way that also brings you there as well. But yeah, for me it's that's why sometimes I like this collaboration, the fact that I feel as though what I'm doing is quite alienating in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, bringing also quite sort of like contemporary or like harsh sort of sound world to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy somehow, he also brings a kind of life into it, which is different to
We are approaching it very differently. Yeah. That's true. That's interesting.
So there's also this kind of dichotomy between his world and my world, which also I feel works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Using this kind of rhombetica as a kind of, you know, prism, like how we're communicating. Yeah.
Well put, Yanni.
Well, I don't know.
Using rhombetica as a prism.
Yeah, that's.
I like it.
It sounds. It's sort of
prison, prison, or prism.
Yeah, exactly.
The guitar playing is great, and there's like times when it kind of matches the kind of the melodic material that Yanni's playing, and then there's other times when it's sort of more abstract and sort of more extended technique, and it's really good. How difficult is it to play? Do you find it difficult to play along to samples?
No, I've got used to it. I think when I first started doing it with Kath Matthews, actually.
Yeah.
And she was also doing live sampling, and she was using this what was it called?
Lisa. That's what I was using as well.
Are you
What's
also
Lisa?
Using
yeah.
live sampling?
It's like a program developed by this place in Amsterdam called Stein. Okay. Used to do like a lot of research into live electronic music.
And I guess live is like a kind of user-friendly, probably taken from a patch from Max or Lisa or one of these things that ended up. So that was the first time. And I remember with her, I never tried to play along. Well, sometimes I tried to play along with her loops and stuff, but her loops were weird because she was picking up bits of my, and then the little be like, and there was no, so I just kind of played along with it. But slowly I got used to it. And I don't... Also, Yanni doesn't play a lot of, like, beat. There's not, like, a beat there. So for me, it's constantly shifting anyway. So there's no point trying to... And that's... for me, that makes it so much more interesting, like, to work with that. But it's... Because the sands are shifting the whole time.
Yeah. But I think, I think this is why I like... working with you from the beginning, like also in the like non-rhombetica stuff, is we have a similar kind of sensibility towards improvisation.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, because that's how we sort of ended up. We played in the early 90s, mid mm-hmm. no late 90s. Sorry.
Yeah.
The there was a kind of improv scene in the kind of a bit in the sort of squat experimental scene in Amsterdam,
yeah.
and. You know, you had people from the more the kind of jazz improv side, you know, let's say the Han Benink type sort of musicians. And then you had more like people into like folk music, more electronic music. Like Andy came from more like punk and I never really got on playing with people who were too sort of in from that kind of jazz improv thing. It was just too... It was too like fast, too busy, too gestural. Yeah. Just didn't really relate
too much
to
information.
That. And about virtuosity and performance. And actually, I really liked when I was playing, started playing out, just getting onto this. And you know, because we both love folk music in some way, traditional. Just getting in this kind of slower, more droney, more kind trying to get into more hypnotic sort of thing. While still keeping it sort of alive, you know, like in some way. And I think that's the sort of way we connect as well with that kind of approach.
Yeah, and for me, I think what I've noticed, I mean, when I improvise with guitar, one of my main, when I'm searching, I'm not searching for melodies, I'm searching for sound, like layers of getting, and I noticed that with Yanni right away, that his... That's a big concern in his palette, is the actual sound, because some of the players that we played with, the scene was called Crackaloud. You had a kind of every week you had a guy with a laptop, another guy with some, and it was great because everyone was trying stuff out. It was like a lab. But sometimes for me the sounds that they chose, I mean, I liked the fact that it was people didn't have control, but some of the sounds did just, you know, sometimes it was just ear splitting or just like granulated or just distorted with digital, and I found it not very beautiful to listen to. But when Yanni played it, he had such a rich, and he used a lot of nice and we didn't have so many subwoofers then, but he used good bass sounds, and just his sounds were like really like stuff I'd thought, wow, I've never heard this sound before in my life. And he didn't have so much control of it in the beginning, so sometimes we would just go like this, and I also really like that element of it. So I think, yeah, we also have a similar attention span. We get bored
about
the same time, so we start shifting.
Yeah.
And Yanni never gets stuck in this kind of, you know, like a loop for longer than like a microsecond, basically.
Yeah.
But it's not because there are other musicians that also have that, they refuse to play loops, but it just becomes hectic, yeah. Kind of.
No, but I have a similar sort of aesthetic when you're talking about Cath Matthews, this way of just kind of floating, not really sort of having a kind of strong beat or loop,
which is
a very clear, gives a very clear sort of rhythm, unless we want that.
Yeah.
But more like kind of flares and floating. Yeah. I mean, I was originally a violinist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was playing like for the guy we met, actually Canadian bass player, Joe Williamson.
Oh, yeah.
I used to play with him, I used to play violin. And blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But he's from Vancouver. But what I like when I started playing electronics, I like the fact that you can just work with sound and just different layers, and that sort of appealed to me much more than trying to do kind of anything with the violin, which is more sort of soloistic or just kind of,
I read your musicology, is that the case? Did you study musicology?
I studied musicology like in England, and then I sort of wanted to study composition, and that's why I came over to Holland to study with Louis Andriessen, this composer there. And that's when I met Andy, not immediately, but I think like 5 years after I came, you know, so we sort of bumped into each other. And and that's why, so I still like, I have this kind of career in classical composition also still, and I teach composition in the Hague Conservatory. So in a way, like, you know, I still, you know, actually with Andy and this other group is the only people I really still improvise with.
Is that a big tension for you between composed music and...
No, because I thought at some point it's something I have to solve, and it does solve itself. I think I see a lot of young composers, musicians, like students of mine have that like dilemma often, you know, that they love improvising but they're a composer, or they have a band but they also compose, you know. And I think it's really okay to just continue with your different, you know, because they sort of feed on, everything feeds on each other.
Yeah.
And like for me, like recently, like I think I would say in the last 10 years or 15 years, I've ended up also doing a kind of composition which somehow brings things together as well. Like I love working now a lot with improvised musicians and creating compositions with them. That's something that, I didn't think I would enjoy doing that, but I think I really get a lot out of that now. Yeah.
So you, as you get older, you become less of a control freak
as
a composer.
I noticed it today
when we were working with the Pozzini Quartet. You gave them a lot of, you know, like it's a piece and they're trying to play it the way it's partly, I mean, it's written right and stuff. And then Yanni goes, yeah, but you know, you also don't have to do it exactly like that. You can also,
yeah.
I mean, he really knows what he wants. So I think sometimes if they're not doing the thing, then he sort of points it out. But there are other moments when it's really left up to the character of the musician, and that will always make it richer.
I mean, we're talking about open scores, so like, and there's a tradition of that, but like often, let's say if people are coming really from the classical tradition, they often ask, am I allowed to do this? Can I do this? And I don't get into this way of thinking you're not allowed. You can do whatever you want. These are just suggestions.
Yeah.
But you have to somehow understand the sort of the identity of the piece, the context of the piece, and then make those decisions as a sort of positive decisions, not like, oh, I'm not allowed to do this, so I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because the minute you think that, I would want to say, well, then do it. You know, do what you're not allowed.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
Correct.
I was just going to ask, outside of this duo, maybe you could just each talk a bit about what else you're working on currently, or what their current projects or obsessions are.
I'm working with a really great, actually a student of Yanni, that's how I met her, Genevieve Murphy. She's a Scottish composer, and she's also a performer, and she does spoken word stuff and plays bagpipes.
Amazing.
And we have a duo. We also play in a band with five, and yes, we do a duo. We've been doing the duo much more because it's also much more easy to get gigs with a duo. And I'm really enjoying like that. And it's a kind of similar setup with Yanni. She has kind of some electronic stuff, but the difference is that she's using, a lot of it is based around her text, and she tells these great stories. She has a really, she really comes from this storytelling tradition.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I love it. It's really fun. And we have a good laugh together also. She has a great sense of humor. And I'm still playing with this sound poet, Angèle Chaton. You know him?
No.
You speak French, right?
Yeah.
He's from Paris, and he does a lot of... he hasn't played very much in Canada, which is
strange.
We played once in Victoriaville.
Yeah.
And we played a little bit, but not much. But he does amazing sound poetry, like really, it's a long story.
Yeah, it's a great project, yeah.
And so he does the text, and I create backing tracks actually for that, that I don't want to deal with having to deal with that stuff, so he just triggers them himself.
Yeah.
And then I play along with him, and that's really...
And yeah, what are you working on?
Well, I mean, we like... Part of the tour now, we're going to be premiering this new string quartet that I wrote. So that's going to be a premiere, like string quartet with Andy, called Cassettes.
Yeah.
And it's sort of it's like a sort of 45-minute piece based on it's kind of also dream related, COVID related project actually. And Andy's playing cassettes through the guitar of
amazing.
Me speaking, but in a kind of encrypted way.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. So it's a kind of beautiful, like long piece, very sort of
we'll do it in
landscape.
When we play in Montreal.
Yeah,
great.
And then I've got a release in December of a kind of also a COVID project which I did, which was is all coming out, which
it's
is
all coming out,
yeah,
then.
Which is this kind of more kind of psychogeographical thing about the place where my dad was born, which is an asbestos mine in Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Canada, you know about asbestos mines,
yeah,
of course. And this was like where my grandfather worked as an engineer.
Yeah.
And so it's like pieces really based on the history of that place. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
My last question is, what is the last book you read, or what book are you currently reading? Or do you not read books?
I'm reading a book actually that Yanni gave to me. So that you asked a good question there. I can't remember the name of it.
It's Nabokov's Dream.
It's by Nabokov. I've got it here. No, I left it. Actually, I left it in the.
Yeah.
But it's great. It's about well, I don't know yet because I've just started it.
Yeah.
But it's about dreams.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a subject that we're both also really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Like we also did a project where Yanni has did the Dreams of the Blind
thing.
And we've done a few things in that. I can't remember the name of the book.
Insomnia, Dreams and Insomnia.
Oh yeah, Dreams and Insomnia.
Okay.
It's like sort of a, it's not a novel, it's more like
a kind of study
notes.
And it's also like, it seems that, like he used his dreams quite a lot to frame his novels, which I didn't realise. Like.
I didn't realise that. What are you reading?
And I'm reading at the moment, I'm a fan of Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish writer, and my wife and I went and saw him in The Hague when he was promoting his new book a few weeks ago. And his new book is called Nights of Plague, and it's also coincidence. It's a kind of book about a pandemic in the beginning of the 20th century in a not specified Greek island under Ottoman rule.
Okay.
I've only sort of read 4 or 5 chapters already, but it's about really this kind of the sort of receding Ottoman Empire and the sort of and how they were grappling with, in a way, dealing with pandemics, which was kind of based on kind of historical data.
Yeah.
And trying to convince certain, you know, that, you know, who is, you know, convinced to quarantine or not, and how they control things. So, I mean, I heard in the talk that the project began actually before COVID.
Really?
And then when when his publisher found out that it was he was writing a pandemic book, he said, no, finish it quickly so we can bring it out. You know, so that, not that I think not that people want to read necessarily books about a pandemic
during
now,
a pandemic.
You know, now that it's over, but it's still a fascinating book.
So, we just put out this great double LP called Clap.
Okay.
And it was the sort of brainchild of this guy we know in Paris. He's a he actually runs an advertising agency, but he's a massive fan of improvised music and like lots of different kinds of music.
Cool.
And so sometimes he puts money when he likes a project. He'll put money into it. He helped us out with Ann James. He helped us out once, and he recently came up to us with his own idea this time. To he said he wanted to invite musicians to make a piece of music based on, and the source material would be an applause, some applause.
Historical applause of some kind, yeah.
So we invited a dozen music. He asked us also to choose a few. And also Yanni's made a piece, I made a piece, and there's a few.
There's like More people. Mother, Scanner, different...
Sounds great.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so a double LP. It was a really nice package. We couldn't bring them with us because they each one weighs about 5 kilos.
Yeah.
But it's a great. That's the most recent thing we did.
I mean, that's the other thing. Is maybe we didn't say is that we have a label together on Sounds.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So that we've I think we released about 70. We have 70 releases for the last 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like.
And we put all our own stuff also on there.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's on unsounds.com.
Thank you.